Before we begin this week's episode, I want to share a book I recently finished by Kensington Publishing. American Fly Girl by Susan Tate Ankeny chronicles the amazing true story of Hazel Ying Lee, an unrecognized pioneer and unsung World War II hero who fought for a country that discriminated against her gender, race, and ambition. Inspired by Amelia Earhart and America's fledgling aviation industry, Hazel was the first Chinese-American woman in U.S. history to earn a pilot's license and fly for the military as a member of the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, or WASPs. Now, I'd heard of the WASPs, but really knew nothing about them or their incredible stories until reading this book. American Fly Girl, the true story of Hazel Ying Lee, who followed her dreams against all the odds and became an American hero, is written by Susan Tate Ankeny and goes on sale April 23rd, 2024, wherever fine books are sold. Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran. Hello, everybody. This is Vincent Aiello from the Fighter Pilot Podcast. We have a special bonus for you today. We've got a long interview coming up on episode 17 on a Desert Storm MiG kill with Nick Mongillo. So in order to save some time on that episode, we are going to cover listener questions here in this bonus segment. This is taken from a June 5th Facebook Live session with episode 5 guest United States Navy Captain Fitz Dud Lee, who's now retired. Anyway, this is that actual replay without any editing at all. So if you did view that either live or on Facebook or on YouTube, then you won't hear anything new here. And we will return to normal scheduling on episode 17. And then on 18, we might have some listener questions at that time, depending on how long that interview goes. So anyway, here is an hour of listener questions with Fitz Lee, callsign Dud. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Fighter Pilot Podcast. We're doing a live question and answer segment today. Put that on mute. And here joining us is episode 5 hero, retired U.S. Navy Captain Fitz Lee, call sign Dud.
Glad to be here, Joe. Thanks.
Great. Well, welcome. I hope everybody can hear us. We're going to try not to hold our microphones. That looked a little awkward last time.
All right.
So if someone wants to comment and say speak up, we'll try to read those. Anyway, we have 6 pages of questions.
All right.
In an hour of time. So I couldn't find the little hourglass thing to flip over, but we're going to try to do a lightning round with our questions, and we will cover as many as we can. Truthfully, I've only printed out 3 of the 6 pages, but we'll get through those. We'll banter back and forth a little bit, and we'll knock off at about 3:30. All right. So let's get going. But before we do, let's talk about you. What is new since we saw you last? Now, I'll caveat that question with when we interviewed, that was last summer.
Yeah, it was.
And you were on active duty. And when we aired your episode, I told them that you had since retired and were flying for a major airline. But what else is going on in your world?
So that indeed is true. I have retired. I'm flying for a major airline. It's a wonderful, great opportunity to have more time at home with the family. Still fly, which is wonderful. And get paid for doing so, which is a requirement living out here in California.
Yeah, and, especially on Coronado.
Yeah, so it's fantastic. It's been great. So spent a lot of time with the family doing community projects. It's been fantastic. So.
Excellent. Okay. I see Jennifer joined us. Jennifer, can you give us a thumbs up if the comms are okay, or do we need to get closer to the microphone? Anyway, well, good. So you're quote-unquote busy flying for the airlines, although not too much.
I'm doing more things at home and with the, like I said, my wife hasn't touched laundry in about 7 months. She's pretty happy about that. So
Dad of the year, just in time for Father's Day, by the way. Nicely done.
After 24 years, though, of handling all the laundry, I got a long way to go to make it up, so that's
okay.
Good.
And she works, so actually you guys can switch the roles a little bit.
Yeah, it's been fantastic.
Okay, outstanding. All right. Well, let's see. I guess we can just get right into it unless there's anything else. So, all right. Well, I'll take the first question. I'll pose it to you. You can answer. We'll, again, do kind of a lightning
round. All right. Is there like a lifeline? If I had to, maybe Jennifer. Yeah, I see your lira up. You maybe can help us.
Yeah, perhaps.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. So the first question is from Steve. This was submitted back in April. So I apologize to my listeners. I've been remiss at getting through our questions. That's why we're doing this today. I don't know where Steve is from. He says, what are your thoughts on the effectiveness of two crew versus one, F-18C or E, versus, he says, F model, but I would put in D or F.
Right.
In a high-intensity environment or in an emergency situation, who performs better, two brains or one? Do two people get in each other's way?
Okay, well, so that's a good, great question, and one that was asked quite a bit, oh, guess what, it's been about a decade ago or more now since we introduced the F-18F to the F-18 community, which in the Navy had traditionally been a single-seat community. I will tell you this, and also in full disclosure, my brother-in-law is a WISO, a backseater in the F-18F. I have flown both single seat and the dual seat, but by far mostly the single seat.
Same.
1 + 1 doesn't always equal 2, and sometimes it can be -1, but I'll tell you, nothing beats an effectively trained crew. It just doesn't. There's so much to do.
By crew, you mean two?
By two.
All right.
Yeah. When you have an effectively, you know, two senior guys in particular, and you know, again, I flew mostly with senior guys. It's hard to beat.
Yeah.
As you know, there's so much to do in that cockpit. When you can effectively task share. Sorry to, you know, all of my, I'm almost
purists.
Yeah, purists out there. I've done both. I still enjoy. Maybe it's because I'm introverted. And still enjoy the single seat.
Flying by yourself?
Yeah, but no question, when you get two people that are court. Now, that's when you get that situation. When you don't, and when I first started, it was difficult. And like I said, 1 + 1, it doesn't always equal 2, and sometimes it could be less than 1.
Yeah.
So if you're not effectively trained, it can, in fact, as Steve mentions, yeah, in fact, you can. You can step on each other. And now once you have confusion inside the cockpit, that detracts from all the things you have to do outside. So
certainly, but especially if you think the other guy is doing something. So like you said, you could actually be less effective than just by yourself. I remember this discussion first coming up when a good friend of mine, Dave Chili Culpepper.
Yeah, no Chili Ball.
Is wrapping up. Yep, yeah. Wrapping up his tour as CEO of Guantanamo Bay. Mm-hmm. We talked about this in Top Gun. And he said to me, Jello, he said, with the right Rio, he was an F-14 guy at the time, he said, I will take that guy any day as a crew of two. He said, the wrong Wizzo or Rio, forget it. I'd rather be on my own. So I think your answer is spot on. It all depends on who. And I bet if I had a Wizzo on here, he would tell me the same thing. Although, of course, he can't fly by himself or she. But the right pilot probably makes their job harder or easier.
Sure.
And so to answer Steve's specific question, certainly in an emergency, I think it's an advantage almost with anyone because some people are not great at tactics and can detract from your situational awareness. But in an emergency, just about anyone's good at, hey, you handle this, and I'll handle that. And usually the pilot is flying and the NFO is communicating. But yes, sometimes they do get in each other's way. And I agree. I spent almost my entire career single seat. But at the weapons school, when I had a chance to fly there with guys like Steiny Acevedo and Ofer, those guys were all Top Gun graduates. It was amazing.
Yeah.
You would go to do a certain maneuver as part of your air-to-air training, and suddenly you had the information. He's telling you things you want to know.
It's
impressive.
Yeah,
I agree. So, all right. Now, that being said, let's add this to it. We did say speed round, but we'll try. If you were to get called back or invited back or whatever, and they said, Dud, we have a one-seat squadron for you or a two-seat squadron for you, not going into too much, you know, explanation on who the backseaters were. Is there one you would take over the other?
Well, I mean, okay, so now being an old guy, haven't been away from. I'll take the two-seater.
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely.
Even if you get a smattering of performance from the guys in the back.
Yeah, okay. I think so.
All right. Well,
but if I had to do it all over again, would I do it differently? No.
Yeah, I agree.
Just because it's just you know, just the way I was raised, the way I do it. Is it again? We just answered this saying that yes, an effective F crew is better than a single pilot. But
sure.
If I had to do it all over again, I'd still do it that way. But I'm glad that we have them out there, and we need to have them out there. But that's also for another question on the package.
I think it's coming up. That's right.
Yeah.
All right, why don't you take this next one from Shane, whose question is from Facebook.
All right. Is a high-intensity environment or an emergency? Oh, no, sorry. That's Shane down here. Sorry about that. If you fly the same airframe, is it possible to switch to a squadron that you want to go to. For instance, when you were a kid and had a favorite squadron, or if your dad was a member of a certain squadron, could you request to go to that one? Well, Shane, great question. Jello?
Well, so I think what he's getting at is if you fly F-18 Super Hornet and you want to go to VFA-4, but your dad was in VFA-5 or whatever, I mean, bad example, but the point being, you can put in your request, but it really comes down to the needs of the Navy. Sometimes if the stars align, it works out that you can go to a particular squadron. If they have an opening, they want you, and your timing works, then you can. But for the most part, you end up going where they need you based on the timing, their own rotation with deployments, and such on, so forth, I should say. Now, it also depends on where you are in your career progression. So it might be time. Let's say you're coming out of flight school as a brand new, you know, student graduate. You're no longer a student. Well, everything I just said is true. They're going to send you where they need young pilots. But later, and you probably dealt with this as CAG Ops, and I did as a training officer, which were sort of equivalent tours. At least, I don't know your experience. I had a chance to kind of shop around some squadrons, and I ended up at VFA 94 because it was in the air wing. I knew everybody. The rotation schedule worked out, and they asked me if I wanted to come, and I wanted to go, so it worked out. Did you have a similar situation with...
So it's ironic, you know, as you get more senior, you have less chances. When I came as a CAG LSO, going back to a squadron, you always put in what you want, and the Navy's going to give you what it needs. They did look at it. The folks at Millington, that's where we do all of our
Millington,
personnel.
Tennessee. Mm-hmm.
And Manning for our pilots. They do what they can, but they're going to have to fill the needs of the Navy. Now, this was a factor. My dad was an F-4 pilot in VF-21. When I was a midshipman, I was out in the Persian Gulf on the Independence, and VF-21 was out there now flying Tomcats.
Wow.
And I asked, hey, could I be, hang out with those guys since my dad was a former? Yeah. And they said, sure enough. That was an easy
cool.
That was an easy ask and an easy answer.
But you're not really involved in the squad.
No.
You're just kind of
a
strap hanger.
But there's no way. So I think ultimately, Shane, no. I mean, you can ask. That's great. Ask for what you want and be happy with what you get.
Yep.
That's exactly
there
how
you
it
go.
Is.
All right. All right, from Michael Brown, not sure where he's from. Do military pilots deployed have any sort of aircrew fatigue mitigation or rules where you can only fly for a certain amount of time and then a certain amount of downtime?
Yes. The short answer is yes.
Absolutely.
That's governed by an instruction, the 3710 instruction in the Navy that all the naval aviators are familiar with, Chapter 8. Our crew day begins at any time our report for flying duties, that starts the clock, and it ends when we're done with not just the flight, but the debriefing and everything that has to do with flight duties. The most that can be is 18 hours, and if it's 18 hours, then we got to have 15 hours of crew rest. Now, caveat all of this discussion, one of the first things that says in our instruction is note, operational commanders, in fact, the senior operational commander who's responsible for aviation operations, which would normally be the CAG, he can waive this.
Okay.
So it's waiverable to the detriment, though, perhaps, obviously increasing, buying some more risk in doing so.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, there's that. There's how many times you can fly in a day, how many flights can be at night. So it's highly it's regulated, and it's spelled out pretty well in our instruction on what we can do. And when we have to, we can get waivers. And I don't know if you had a cruise like that, but when we were in Operation Iraqi Freedom, we were flying a tremendous amount and all past those limits because we had folks that we had to support on the ground, and we did it.
And you just try not to make a routine of it, but yeah, you're right. You can go up to that, but let's talk about normal every day. So if you're shore-based between deployments, typically 12 hours is the expectation. So if you're flying and you're going to land and debrief and be done, let's say, by 11 p.m. at night, well, then not only should you not show up before 11 a.m., but if you did, they'd probably get upset at you because now your 12-hour day starts earlier, so you couldn't come in. Now, on the carrier, you might be tempted to ask, based on Dud's answer, well, but you're always on the ship. How do you do that? And the point is you just try to stay out of the ready room. You try to stay away from any official duties. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you can't get off the carrier, but you can sleep as much as you can. You can exercise. You can go get chow. You can even probably visit your shops if you have a maintenance shop that you're in charge of. But for the most part, you don't show up and start planning your mission or writing the schedule or whatever your collateral duty is.
No, that all starts the clock. And we're supposed to have, also in the instruction, an opportunity, note the word opportunity,
mm-hmm.
for 8 hours of uninterrupted
right.
sleep. So, of course, that's also how do you do that on a carrier? Well, you get used to it, actually. But yeah, so it is regulated, and it's already been demonstrated by many studies that obviously the more fatigued you are, the less capable you are. Mm-hmm. In fact, it equates to almost being under the influence of alcohol.
Oh, yeah. They've done studies. Absolutely.
So it's very important, not often waived, but it can be and when it has to be. And so it is, and we do what we need to do to get the mission done. I will say our Air Force brothers and sisters are a little bit seem to be a little bit more stringent on theirs. I don't know how their instruction reads, but like I said, right from the beginning, ours is waiverable, and when operations make it requirement, and that's, you know, people's lives are at stake, we're going to do what it takes to get the mission done.
For sure. And to your point, we try to provide an opportunity for 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep, yeah. Which usually, again, ashore means, in my previous example, if you're done at 11, even if the next day you're not flying at all, you would expect to hear them say, you would just do it. Don't come back before 11 because that's when you left here the night before.
Yep.
All right. You want to take Rob's again from Facebook?
All right. Rob, thanks for I can see that there's folks joining, and if I could really see that far without the aid of glasses, I'd welcome you all, but I can't see anything. It's all blur to me, so right. Jello over to you, but thanks for joining us. Question after listening to Top Gun and Vietnam Ace episodes. If soft deck for training is 10K feet altitude, how do pilots develop low-level ACM skills as demonstrated in actual combat situations? The aircraft performance varies at altitude. How is this gap in training rules covered? Very good question, Rob.
Absolutely. So just to remind everybody, so the soft deck is an altitude above the actual ground where when we are doing training dogfighting that we then restrict ourselves to certain parameters and minimum airspeeds so as not to depart controlled flight. And then what you have is the hard deck, which is 5,000 feet above the actual ground or water. And at that point, if you dip below that, you treat it like the actual ground. If you hit it by even 10 feet, you are a rocks kill, as we call it. So to answer your question, Rob, what we do is we accept the fact that when the chips are down and life or death is on the line, that you are going to do anything in your power to avoid the rocks and trees and mountains and mobile homes or whatever's out there when you're fighting for your life. Because if you don't, you give up, you're going to die. And most fighter pilots aren't going to do that. But to the genesis of your question, the way we simulate that is, if you think about, particularly an F-18, which is our experience, if you're going to go into combat, you're going to have probably all on a Hornet and most on a Super Hornet of the external pylons under the wing. And those extract a toll on performance. So in training such as Top Gun, what they may do is they will not have all the pylons. And they've done studies to show that if we only have a certain number of them when we're doing, or none of them, frankly, when we're doing dedicated BFM, basic fighter maneuvers, that the performance at 5 and 10,000 feet MSL, if you, in fact, are above, let's say, the actual ocean. If you're in Fallon, you're actually up quite a bit higher because the ground is quite a bit higher. But at regular 5 to 10,000 feet MSL, that your performance is roughly the same as it would be at about zero or over the water.
The only thing I add is that, and it's a great question, that the biggest performance issues that you're going to have that are safety related, I think that's kind of what Rob's saying, hey, you're close to the rocks. Mm-hmm. Is we have other training that we do, low altitude training that kind of trains you in how to fly in low altitude environment. And then G onset's the biggest thing because you have a lot more G available down there in that thick air. And quite frankly, if you've down at 5,000 feet, AGL over the water or over, you know, Death Valley, that's pretty good performance.
Oh, yeah.
So we have ways of, we've trained through that risk mitigation, I think, in other ways as well. And then you can see the performance. It's a great question. Now, we can do ACM. I've been in the large force exercises out at Nellis where that's the only time I've ever done low altitude, you know, at 500 feet ACM. It's 180 degrees a turn. It's pretty impressive. But again, we train to that. And again, it's a risk mitigation, right? Because you wouldn't want to go out of control at 3,000 feet because that's where you're training. Because then you would have to eject out of the aircraft.
Almost right away, because otherwise your rate of descent could be so great that you don't have enough time. So
it's a cost-benefit analysis, and I think we do fine by our current training rules.
Yeah, I agree. All right, I think what's next for me. So Tomaz asks, what's your opinion? I don't know if we can answer this one or not. What's your opinion of the F-35? We can certainly answer that. Have you had any personal experience with it, or have you asked others who had experience with it?
I have. I've pet one once because it was, I called it the mythical unicorn. We've been expecting the F-35 since about 2012, and as some of you may know, we in the Navy, we haven't yet introduced it officially, IOC'd it yet. That's coming later this year.
The Marines have.
The Marines have.
The B model.
That's an interesting discussion as well, but I'll stay away from that one. And I have certainly no friends that have flown it. And here's what I will say. And in fact, I talked to a JO at the Naval Aviation Museum about a month ago. I was there and asked this Marine captain who was flying it, give it to me straight. And, you know, I trust the JOs. And he says, I'll take this airplane right now. And this is the B model into war where it's designed to go in those high threat. And I was like, well, that's a pretty good endorsement.
Yeah, for sure.
It's got some work to do. It's a very, very expensive airplane. And, you know, it's the largest DOD acquisition program in all time as far as costs go. So
that's amazing, by the way.
Yeah. And it's going to be an amazing and a great airplane. Right. It's unfortunate it's taken so long to get here.
I think that's a result of the complexity.
That and the fact that we have so many players, international and everything else.
True.
So I think we've learned a lot in the United States in general, not just the Navy.
Right.
But and maybe we don't want to go down this kind of big path again. But it's going to be a great airplane. And what our national leaders have to balance in a resource-constrained environment is how much do we, you know, how much can we afford?
Right.
And it's going to be very, very expensive. And the Navy's thought about that. But I think we have a question coming up that talks a little bit more about that. If not, let me just touch on it right now.
We can always say we are touched on it.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's we're not going to have the air wing of the future that we envision here in the next 20 years is not going to have more than one F-35 squadron in an air wing.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so it's going to be an F-35 squadron and three Super Hornet squadrons. We're not going to have a lot of them. We just can't afford a lot of them, but they are going to give us some tremendous capabilities. And I will also say, having done a lot of integration with the F-22, working with Super Hornets, the integration of the fourth and fifth generation fighters is a really nice compromise, if you will. Like, sure, we'd love to have all F-35s, but we can't afford them.
Yeah.
The integration of the two is going to be quite an impressive capability as we move forward. So very expensive, very capable, and if the guys flying it right now say they'd like to take it to war where it's designed to go, then that's a pretty good endorsement. And it's not even, you know, there's still some things that are going to be upgraded here, moving, you know, in software, and everything continues to improve. So future's bright for that.
Thomas, my answer to this is simply I have no experience with it. I've had anecdotal experiences like I just had with Dud. And I don't know why, but I missed all the in-briefs and all the different discussions as I was transitioning out, and so I just never really became aware of anything. So, but everything I've heard is pretty good. But, yeah, to your point, very complex with so many partners with all compete, not all competing needs, but a lot of competing needs, international players. And I heard at one point parts of this airplane were made in 48 out of 50 states.
Yeah, but you see that in the Hornet as well.
Do you? Okay.
So as you know, I worked on Capitol Hill,
right.
And that's just part of the politics of everything.
That way nobody cancels the program
because
everybody loses jobs in their constituency.
Yeah.
Great.
All right. Would not point at the F-35 as a great acquisition strategy or a great example of acquisition. In fact, it's pretty poor, but only exceeded maybe by the B-22 Osprey.
Oh, dear.
So we hope as we move forward into the FX, which is now under development, which is the fighter beyond the F-35, that we hopefully learn some lessons and do it a little better moving forward.
Okay. Why don't you take Stevens from the UK, or at least that first part, we can break it up.
All right,
if you
from
want.
The UK, love London. I was there last year with the family. It was fantastic.
Great.
What do you think of the F-35 not having a gun? Only the U.S. Air Force version will have a cannon. And I think he goes on to say the F-35 will use missile only. And what's your opinion of the shoot down of this here? And do you want to get on that later?
Let's start with
the F-35. And what do you think of the Air Force having the internal gun and our model, the C model, not having one?
I think it's a bad idea because I think we proved in Vietnam with the F-4 that a gun is handy. Now, that being said, I understand that compromises are necessary.
There you go.
And it is my opinion, or guess, I should say, that the Air Force variant, the F-35A, was sufficiently light enough that they could afford to put one inside, whereas the B, with its vertical short takeoff landing V-stall, you've heard us mention that term on the show before, and the C model, which has to have all the gear it needs to land on a carrier, that my guess is the engineers just could not make it work. You just can't get from here to there. You know, it's like, just physics-wise, it didn't work. So I temper my comment with it's a bummer that it wasn't capable, but I realize it was probably a trade-off, and they have a pod instead, and will they load up the pod and just have it on all the time, in which case it's always going to be heavy and less stealthy anyway? I don't know, but it is a bummer, but compromises have to be made. I mean, you look at any airplane, the F-18, certainly F-15 and 16, all through aircraft development, it's a series of compromises and trade-offs. I think Sunshine talked about that actually on our last Facebook Live session. No one aircraft does everything perfectly, and so that probably was a result of that as well.
And I think you nailed it, gentlemen. We talked about it before. It's about compromise. Yeah. Not ideal, but there's a lot of smart people trying to make hard decisions. And in this case, they elected not to have an internal gun. And I think for all the reasons you said, it's great. Well, I see some questions here. Do you take the questions
We hit those at the end. We'll try to get through
these lightning round for you.
Yeah,
all folks,
about 45 minutes of these, and then we'll scan that. It's always a creepy part, though, because you got to get real close to read it.
I can sort of see one there. David or Jason, I see your question. We'll try to get
all
to
right,
it.
We'll get to you. Let's see. So I'll hit you on the next part. This is still Stephen from the UK. Basically what Stephen is at, well, I'll just read it. The F-35C will use missile only, and what your opinion is on the shootdown of the Syrian Su-22 fitter by the FA-18E from VFA 87, which was assigned to Carrier Air Wing 8. He certainly did his homework.
Yes.
Its pilot engaged the fitter and initially fired an AIM-9X Sidewinder close range heat-seeking missile from about a half a mile, which was defeated by flares, his words, not mine, launched by the Su-22 pilot. The Super Hornet then re-engaged and fired an AIM-120 AMRAAM, which hit the fitter despite being fired from relatively close range. How did a 30-year-old Su-22 defeat a modern AIM-9X?
Well, I think we'd have to interview the pilot who had to end up ejecting out of that airplane to answer that question. In all honesty, there's not a way to do that. We don't have enough information, and if we did, we probably couldn't, given our backgrounds, wouldn't be appropriate to really comment much further. I will say this, the airplane was shot down, so congratulations to the whole team who did that. There is a, and I don't have it here, but you can do a YouTube search, and you can hear the pilot who flew the mission and the folks that were involved in the mission real time talk about it at last year's Tailhook convention. It's worth it if you want to know more about how it all went down. They did a great job. They did their job, and eventually they shot the airplane down. His call sign again was
Mob.
Yeah, and like we're all tight. So when something doesn't work. Try something else. And he did. He switched to AIM-120, and it blew the guy up.
Good on him, yeah.
And so, other than that, I wouldn't lose heart in the AIM-9X. It's an amazing missile, and there's not enough information, even when you listen to Mob's recount, to understand what may or may not have happened.
True. Yeah, and I'm trying to get in touch with Mob Grand from Episode 7, tried to put me in touch with him. So one of these days, if we can connect and he's willing, we'll try to get him on the show. But we may not connect, and he may be unwilling. I don't know. But, you know, Stephen, your question was, what is your opinion on this whole situation? And I would say to that, if I may get semantic, that it's hard to have an opinion when I know certain things from our career as fighter pilots that we can't disclose in unclassified settings. So, I think Fitz hit it on the head. Things happen. We don't know if maybe that missile had a problem. Maybe there was some one-in-a-million thing that manifested itself in the first, as I understand, combat employment of that weapon. But I'm not going to either offer answers or excuses because, frankly, I just don't know. Same as you said.
But I'm glad we have the AIM-9X.
Yep.
So,
all right, I think Stephen's last one is here. I'll ask it to you. Why does the United States Marine Corps use a lot of FA-18D? Does this model of the Hornet have an extra capability over the C model?
Nope, has no. In fact, it is the C with two seats, 800 pounds.
And a little less gas. You think we're just about to get there, yep.
800 pounds less gas. But this gets to that earlier question, you know, do we have what's better, a single seat or dual seat? Well, the Marine Corps, takes its mission of supporting troops on the ground very seriously, as we all do. But it's their bread and butter, right?
That's right.
They talk about joint warfighting. The Marines have been doing it from their birth. These guys are second to none when it comes to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that FACA mission that they do, and that we do as well, is a two-seat mission in the Navy and Marine Corps. And so they needed to have that two-seat version. It is, in fact, a Charlie model with just less gas. And to make it easy, we have the F-18A. We made a two-seat version. Anyone want to guess out there?
They've seen episode 6, or 10.
It was the B, then the C, and then the two-seat version of the D. Now, after that, it kind of breaks because the E and F are quantum leap above the other one, and it's a new design. But it's the same thing. E, single seat.
That's right.
F is the dual seat of the E. The G is what breaks the the paradigm.
Yeah, they should have skipped right to H or something.
Yeah, but anyway. Okay. So anyway, that's it. They do it because they have that FACA mission. That's primarily why they have single seats as well, and that's what they'll send to the aircraft carrier air wings when we integrate on time to time.
Yep.
But for that FACA mission, they got the D model.
Okay. Yeah, nothing to add. I agree.
Navy bought those too. We bought two seat models, but we use them all for the FRSs training.
True. The Navy does. That's true. And just a quick note on that, an F-18B and D, and F, I guess, can be configured so that the back seat is for the Wizzo, which has the side controllers and all the HOTAS that he or she gets back there, or another stick and throttle for first flight or follow-on flight. All right. Why don't you go with Mark? We're not sure where he's from.
Okay. Mark asked, did you ever get to sit in the cockpit of a foreign, non-American produced, friendly or otherwise, aircraft, and what struck you about foreign air forces as utter strange? Maybe I should have taken that one.
Well, you can have a go in a second, but yes, I did get to sit in a MiG-29 Fulcrum.
Oh, even better.
And yeah, it was neat. It was just, you know, it was foreign to me, so it just struck me as different and odd, but given enough time to get used to it, I probably could have flown the thing and become accustomed to it. But the layout, the gauges, of course, the I don't even know, what do you call the Russian Cyrillic or whatever the language is?
Yeah.
It's not English. Is that what it's called? Okay. So all that to me, just the whole experience was very foreign. The way they have their stick is positioned a little differently, with a little more of a twist to it. And you sit a little more, it seemed like to me in that aircraft, a little more upright. So it felt very foreign. But at that time, I'd flown nothing but the F-18 after training, and so I was very used to that. So I think I could have jumped in probably an F-15 and felt, you know, some things look somewhat similar, but it would still feel a little bit foreign. So for me, it was a MiG-29 Fulcrum.
Yeah, for me, it was a MiG-19, Pakistani MiG-19 out of Karachi.
You got to sit in it?
Oh, and then fly it.
You have to fly it?
Yeah, so we're, yeah.
No way.
So, yeah, so.
Wait, not by yourself?
No, I had a... I don't know what the guy's name was up front. I probably couldn't pronounce it very well, even if I knew it. I do have a distinct memory, though. Again, this is Karachi, Pakistan, a city of 20 million people. But where the base was, it seemed like it was a base of 100 people. Yeah. There's a whole bunch of bearded guys looking up at me. And it's not a very high ride up there in the MiG-19. And I just thought, what did I just sign myself up for? and of course, now it's not really fair. I mean, this is late 1950s technology here. So the little stick with a little bicycle brake and all the things that I saw there were, again, a little more awkward, not as well engineered as, say, 1980s F-18. I wasn't expecting that, but it was quite an experience. The flight went fine. It reminded me of flying the T2 Buckeye, big straight wing. It didn't bleed much in turns. It was kind of interesting, and we made it back. I guess of note, though, and I had reason to be cautious, by our CAG the next day flew the equivalent. It's Chinese made, but of basically a MiG-21.
Okay.
Pakistani MiG-20.
F7 or something.
Yeah. And the canopy fell off on that one in flight.
Just fell off.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway, it was interesting. It is rare, though, and both of us are fortunate to have, I think, to have done that. We don't do enough of that. We have pep tours where people can go fly different tours, but it's rare to get the opportunity. So I was happy to go. First of all, to go see a different country.
Yeah,
you know, going to Pakistan and
probably got off the boat for a little while to go do that.
Exactly.
There you go. That's always a win.
Yeah, and not maybe as big a win as you would hope, but it was still a win. But it was good. It was a good experience.
Cool. PEP means what? Personal Exchange Program. So we have Aussies and Brits that come over here, and we send folks. So I had a friend who went and flew with the Swiss Air Force.
Yep, F-18s.
Cool. All right, why don't you take Brad Wolf's question from Facebook?
All right, Brad from Facebook. Have you ever dropped something in the cockpit and gone inverted in order to hopefully retrieve it?
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, I did not. It was my functional check flight checklist. And it's a little, like this, and you write down when you do certain things. And I put it on my kneeboard and didn't secure it well enough and went to do something and off it drifts behind me and dang it. So I had to do a little bit of finessing to try to get it and roll up and side down and push, and it didn't come back. And this was on the ship until, can you guess when I finally got it back?
On the trap.
Exactly. It flew up and came up to the windscreen and just grabbed that, stuck it in my nav bag. And
nothing to see here.
Check off everything else that was done because I remembered from memory and off I went. But I did hear anecdotally of an F-14 crew, I don't know if this is true or not, but it makes a good story, so let's call it true, who accepted an F-14 from another squadron because we sometimes move aircraft back and forth between squadrons. And the first thing you do when you get a new airplane is that functional check flight. And on their inverted check, he said he found a moldy peanut butter and jelly sandwich in a plastic bag.
Classic.
I don't know if that's true or not, but it's fun enough, yeah. So we'll pretend it is.
Yeah.
How about you?
I know I have. I can't remember what it was for. Couldn't have been all that important. And I do have a memory of being, I don't know, maybe I'm batting 50%. I'm on occasions like, yep, I got what I needed, or no, I didn't. And then what's worse is you've got to go tell maintenance about it because something's in the cockpit. That downs the airplane. So
didn't
happen a lot, but you'll try anything not to have to be able to make that call to maintenance saying, hey, jet's down for FOD in the cockpit.
Yeah, no. Jet's down. What for?
Yeah, exactly.
Fog in the cockpit. What? Yeah, right. Fog in the cockpit. Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
By the way, we, as you know, part of our combat G-awareness and the things we do before we go into even training is to do that inverted check for lots of reasons, not just, so we pull, go 90 right for 4 and 90 back the other way for 6, and then, roll inverted to check to see that there's nothing in there. So we're doing that kind of stuff.
And have you ever, while inverted, like little bits of things?
Yeah.
Like trying to...
little dust things, but yeah, nothing big. Yeah, but, yeah.
Dust bunny, not bunnies, but whatever. Yeah. Anyway. All right. Next one I think is for you. It's from Leif from Sweden, but he lives in the UK.
So my cousins are Swedish, born and raised there. I was in Stockholm last year.
You have a connection with everybody.
Yeah.
This should be your show. All right. Are you issued additional items such as, he's from Sweden, so he's asking about warm clothing.
Oh, yeah.
Are you issued additional items such as warm clothing, thick gloves, woolly hat, etc.? If you operate in a winter Arctic climates, could you elaborate on any additional cold weather survival gear you may be issued?
Yes. The short answer is yes. Most of us, Jello, myself included, have not really operated. In fact, where we're operating, it's quite warm. Up in Fallon, though, where I did my last bit of flying, I actually got some really nice cold weather gear because out there, if you have to get out of the airplane, it's cold when it's wintertime and you flew up there.
And you're going to be there a while before the helicopter can come get you.
Yep, so you get gloves, you get nice hats, shirts you can wear underneath that are nice, keep you warm. The dreaded one, though, that we all fear and we all have is the poopy suit.
The dry suit?
The dry suit, yes. Dry suit that we put on, and it's, it's like climbing into a dishwasher glove, I guess. It's really
tight.
That's
a good way to put it.
And until they, and for most of our careers, they had this old neck that was just, it almost asphyxiated you, wearing that thing. And I think I wore it once only, because again, if we're flying over water that require temperatures that require us to increase our survival time, we have to wear that.
Right.
So that would be the other piece of major cold weather gear that we get. That's the one that I've worn. The other stuff that I talked about, you really don't, you wear some of it when you're flying, you got it, and it's comfortable. That the dry suit is, generally speaking,
awful.
Pretty awful.
Yes.
Because you're putting it on, like in Lemoore, where we flew a lot, you're putting it in 90-degree weather, putting it on in 90-degree weather.
And then pre-flighting the aircraft.
Yeah. I mean, you've lost 20 pounds before you even start the engine. So.
But to your point, when you go 100 miles west and you're out over the water, it's not just, if I may add to what you're saying, it's not just the water temperature, but also the time to survive,
or
time to rescue.
Yeah.
So if you're going to be in a certain temperature for 10 minutes, you might need to wear it. If you're going to be in something quite a bit warmer, but for an hour, if you were to go down as they would expect the helicopter to get to you, then you may also need it. Yeah, so to your point, when you had that real tight thing on, you didn't want to do any turning of your head because you'd come back with a surfer rash, and it was just awful.
No matter what you did, you were just, messed up.
That's right. All right, we're doing pretty well. We got about another 10 minutes of these, and then we'll take a look at what folks got there. Do you want to take, looks like, two parts here from Jordan in Ireland? So just take that first part.
Do you have experience flying only the one-seater F-18 Hornet or Super Hornet, or have you flown in both the one- and two-seat configurations? How transferable are the skills for a pilot between the two? And he says, type rating, does that exist in military aviation? It kind of does, by the way. Is it common for pilots to swap between squadrons of one- or two-seaters?
So my experience through my F-18 life, if you will, was first two-seaters because, let's say you were my instructor and I was your student. I'm in the front. You're in the back on the very first flight. You make sure everything's cool. And then a couple flights like that, and then I'm in a single seat or a two-seater with the back seat empty. And then in my case, it sounds like yours too, I spent most of the rest of my career in single seat. It wasn't until after I was a department head, I'd been in the Navy, I got there in 06, so I'd been in the Navy 14 years, where I first started flying tactically with WISOs. And we've already touched on this earlier in this Facebook Live session, but I really enjoyed it because the guys I flew with were fantastic. So Bloach, who was on the show earlier, like I already said, Steiny, Ofer, a few others I'm sure I'm forgetting, but they were phenomenal. But to your point, the skills are transferable, but there are some things that I was used to doing that suddenly I wasn't doing.
Right.
And I'll give you a very easy one, communicating with air traffic control.
Oh,
And not doing the communicating, I found it skipped a part of my brain.
Absolutely.
And so I would miss level off altitudes. I would miss headings.
Never miss a call when you're flying the airplane just by yourself. Yep. Had the same exact experience.
Yeah. So, the short answer, I think, is very easy to go from one to the other with some proficiency, jumping from one to the other. But it does take some, I don't know, situational awareness on your part to go not only the way I went, but I've heard other people who went all two-seaters to a single seat suddenly were forgetting to do things because they were used to someone else doing them.
Exactly. That was exactly my experience. For the type rating piece, if you want to think of it in type ratings, A through D are all single type rating, if you will. No required training to go in between. If you go from being flying those airplanes to the Super Hornet, that's a quick five-hour syllabus. But right. You do have to do a five-hour syllabus.
There's enough common in between the two that give you the differences.
And now you're good. You could theoretically now fly the EF or G. Now the G is a completely different mission, and you would need training for that mission set. But the actual flying and type rating, E through G would be the same type.
That's right. The G apparently has a few different emergency procedures and some other system stuff because it is plumbed for electronic attack. So, all right. And just to the point, yes, instead of calling it a type rating, which you and I each have in our own aircraft at our airlines, we call it a NATOPS qual. Yeah. So at one point, I had three NATOPS quals. I had A through D Hornet, EF Super Hornet, that was before the G joined the group, and F-16AB. So I had three at once at one point.
I had two. It just wasn't as cool. It was a T-34C instead of the F-16. But
But
as a CAG LSO, I did get a chance to fly all of the airplanes off the carrier, which is cool.
Oh, very good. Yeah, that's good stuff. All right, let's see. Mine to you then, right? So still Jordan from Ireland. I know there are some roles that only the two-seat Hornet can perform. We talked about that earlier, mainly forward air control, airborne. Yep. With the introduction of the F-35 and eventual retirement of the Hornet, what do you see as taking over those roles? Possibility of two-seat F-35 for the Navy, or are the automated systems in the F-35 advanced enough? The Rio Wizzo will soon become an endangered animal.
Okay, so make this a speed round. We can do it quickly. Yeah, there won't be, as I touched on earlier, for the foreseeable future, next couple decades, it's a single F-35 squadron, single seat, with three Super Hornet squadrons, one of which will be the F squadron.
Right.
So, no, Wizzos aren't going away. They're only, you know, then it's only one squadron per air wing, but they're not going away. There won't be a two-seater F-35. Nope. That's not going to happen. So,
and that's not new. They've had single-seat aircraft since the F-14. I mean, you'd put a pilot in the back, but the first time you flew, you were flying. And same with the A-10 and a few others.
Yeah, I think we covered that.
All right. But I guess, will the backseater soon become an endangered animal? I guess not, because you said they'll have an F-squadron.
Yeah, we're going to.
And the Gs.
Yep.
And the Gs.
Yep.
All right.
Different mission set. They're actually called EWOs.
ECMOs. Is it EWOs?
EWOs now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Electronic Warfare Officers.
I think I've been saying that wrong on the show.
Yeah, so they're EWOs in the back of the G instead of ECMOs, which is what they were in the back of the Prowler. And then we have our Wizzos. And those are two distinct mission sets.
Gotcha. I can't remember who asked that one, but I'm going to ask this one because it's about carrier ops, and I think you can touch on it pretty well with your CAG ops background. So speaking for carrier flight operations, does only one squadron fly at a time? This will be a pretty easy one. This is from Steve in Canada. But he does say, I'm sure that answer is no. So how about we just say no? So pretending here, he says, if VF-103 and VF-96 are going at it, the CAT, the safety, LSOs, for example, do they all stay the same for that cycle, or do they change guys? Let me just paraphrase this. What if a Hornet squadron is flying with the Greyhounds and all that? I think you get the point. Do they change everyone from the brown shirts, yellow shirts? So getting the point of it, tell us how it works.
Yeah, it's an air wing team. We're all working together up there. So we have folks that are specialized troubleshooters for each aircraft. They go with that aircraft up to the catapult. But we train together. We work together as an air wing. So it mixes completely. And, in fact, sometimes in extreme circumstances, you alluded to it earlier, sharing aircraft, or at least donating to another squadron. We took it one step further in our operational Iraqi Freedom. It was different crews, but we're still over Iraq. We actually shared pilots.
Oh, wow.
And because there were, with the duties that we had to do for strike planning, there weren't enough pilots to meet the mission requirements. So we would share. We had a memorandum of understanding. And so we actually shared pilots. I would fly my sister squadron's aircraft and vice versa. It didn't work out well for one of our aircrafts, as it turns out. It diverted into Al-Asad. It then got full of gas on a hot summer day, started to take off. Unfortunately, in the X-Wing fighter configuration, meaning the wings were still folded. So somebody screamed at him to abort. The pilot aborted. Thank goodness he was safe. And you can imagine it almost like a cartoon, like just a Bugs Bunny. You know, happy to be alive. Can't believe what he just did. Takes a big sigh of relief and sets the parking brake. You want to have a guess what happens when he sets the parking brake?
Keeps all the heat in there and it just blows festers.
Up and becomes a fire and a Class Bravo mishap. So
now,
anyway.
Not to derail your story, but he could have done that in his own airplane.
He couldn't, right, but as it turns out, he did it
the other, so put some egg on
faces. So anyway, we all fly together, we all train together, and when necessary, we even share each other's food, so to speak, to get the mission done.
Yep.
And that's exactly what we need.
Yeah, Steve, we talked about this on episodes 11 and 12 with Pappy, and the yellow shirts, the, gosh,
green
how
shirts,
many? I think
brown shirts.
Yellow, whites. Well, the yellow is all ship. The green can be ship or squadron, but the ship's green and the ship's just those.
Purple is just a ship.
Oh, purple, thank you. Yeah. So those will be for everybody. And then you'll have specialized, like Fitz just said, for your squadron, like when you're doing your startup or when you're on the catapult. But otherwise, every squadron's going to fly almost every cycle, and paddles will wave no matter who's coming down, according to CAC Paddles' direction. And so it's all one giant team.
Yeah.
All right, I think we have time for we're getting close. Yeah. One more quick one. Well, I don't know if it's quick or not. I haven't read what it is. How long... Who read that one? Anyway, I'll read it to you. This is from Zachary on Facebook. How long exactly does it take to do all those operations to launch a single plane, again, on the carrier? If operating at full launching capacity, how quickly can the carrier launch planes? If the carrier had to scramble a large amount of planes to take on an incoming threat, how long would that take? So this actually could be a long answer, but let's just hit some of the highlights.
So we can launch and recover simultaneously. The deck has to be spotted correctly to do what what Zachary is maybe referring to. If it were a pop-up threat, that could be an issue. But we can launch a plane every, 45 seconds.
Probably less. I mean, if you got all four loaded, you could shoot them all four at
once. Yeah, we can shoot them pretty quick. Yeah, in fact, we can do cubby launches and other things. We can shoot them quick. But if we're launching and recovering simultaneously, we try to recover aircraft anywhere from 45 to 60 seconds. So that's standard.
Yeah.
So... And then after that is what you can launch off the front end. So relatively quickly.
Let me put a different spin on this answer, if I may, Zachary. The longest it could take is weeks. Now, bear with me, right? Before a ship goes anywhere, we've got pre-sale meetings. We've got all the operations. I mean, there's so much that goes involved to getting a ship out where it can do it. And then once you're on the ship, then it's just a question of, like Dud said, the spotting, the posture that you're in. And so the shortest, if weeks is the longest, the shortest is maybe as little as 5 minutes if you have alert sevens, which I've stood. That is where you're in the airplane.
I've launched on.
Waiting, and I have too, and it took me about 5 minutes. In fact, I was on alert 15, which is where I'm wearing my gear in the ready room downstairs, and got called away, and I was airborne in about 7 minutes. But to your point, if there's a giant incoming threat and you know about it, you might have what's called an alpha strike ready, where everybody's been briefed, the planes are fueled and loaded, and they're all ready. And if they get the word, uh-oh, here comes the enemy, or uh-oh, we need to go attack, then they could have all 20 aircraft launched from the word go in, I don't know, maybe...
10 minutes?
10?
15?
I was going to say 20. I mean, if everyone's not in their jets, I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
Everybody's going to run up there and go. So it depends on the threat.
And you hit on it. If we're not aware that that kind of threat exists, that should never be a pop-up threat, a huge bunch of people coming out of our ship. But we should know about that well in advance.
Right. If we were off the coast of southern Florida and suddenly the Conch Republic or whatever comes out after us, then we've failed ourselves. So, all right, Dad, let's give everybody an extreme close-up of our beautiful faces here.
All right.
And we will zoom up to the top. And we might be quiet a little bit. We're going to scan through and see how it's going. And now you can... see my hair that's growing out that I desperately need a haircut. All right, so I got thumbs up on the audio, so that's good. Oh, there's Rhett. Yeah, I need to talk to him about... Rhett, give me a shout, dude, when you get a chance. We need to talk about, if you're still connected to VTs, we need a show on that. Everybody is asking who's heading to flight school.
There's the one from Jason that I think I saw.
Go ahead and start reading while I'm looking at the other.
Jason talks about, are all adversary pilots Top Gun grads? Is there a specialized curriculum for adversary pilots versus fleet pilots? And that's a great question. So to the first part, no, not all adversary pilots are Top Gun grads, but our highest level of adversary are Top Gun grads through the adversary program at Top Gun, which is different than what Jello went through. Jello went through the Blue program, which is the longer and more, it's a more in-depth syllabus on doing a Blue Air.
Right.
But In fact, do you do part of that Red Air syllabus as part of it?
When you graduate with a blue patch, we talk about this on episode 7 with Grand.
Grand was a department head of mine, by the way. Great.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Training officer.
Yeah. Do you hear he's going to take VFA 125?
Fantastic.
Dude's just going up and up.
Yeah.
You end up with a Top Gun patch with a basic adversary qualification, and then you just have to do a couple upgrade flights to get the rest of it.
Yep. I flew adversary missions, totally non-qualified as a Top Gun adversary, but qualified through the internal process.
Right.
So it is different. And we had, and we still do, in our blue, in our fleet syllabus, train to a Red Air, some Red Air proficiency, because, unfortunately, we have to provide a lot of our internal Red Air, and we want to do that professionally and give our guys the best training we can. So we train to it even in the fleet. We're trying to get away from it as much as we can because our airplanes need a little bit of rest, and what flying they do needs to be on our blue side, not the
right.
red side.
For sure.
Good question, though.
All right, I'll ask you this one from Bruce. Hey, guys, always wondered, do you have de-ice, anti-ice on the F-18? I never see any boots or hot strips. How do you guys fly in icing?
This is the coolest answer ever. We go faster.
Cool. Yeah, I like that.
Because that's what we do. Because with the airplanes we fly now, have all that stuff.
That's right.
It's not cool. What we do, well, first of all, you try to avoid it.
That's right.
Yeah, that's the first thing. No airplane wants to be, I don't ever want to be in ice, even in the airplanes that are designed to be able to fly in it. We just fly faster, and that is simply we have an engine anti-ice switch.
Correct.
But after that, it's fly faster and have the friction of the air over the jet keep it warm enough to
prevent ice. So anti-ice, no de-ice, and you try to avoid it.
Yep.
All right. Typically, how many hours? This is from Neil Braden. How many hours needed in the F-18 before heading out on your first carrier landing training? So this one could be for you.
Well, I came right out of the FRS, and I was out on cruise within 60 days.
Well, so I think what he's asking is how many hours in the F-18 before heading out on your first carrier landing?
Oh, your first carrier. Oh,
so this
yeah.
would be in the FRS.
Yeah, so we do that at the end of the syllabus.
But it's not based on hours. It's based on progressing through the syllabus, right?
It is, and I can't remember. Sorry if there's even a technical. There may be a technical
like a
requirement.
Minimum
I think it's
hours.
Minimum hours,
yeah.
like 50 or so. But the bottom line, it's always at the end of the syllabus. So at that point you have around 100 hours or so. You've already, as a naval aviator, you've done daytime landings in nowadays a T-45.
Right.
I did it in the A-4. Did you have A-4?
A-4, yeah.
Yeah. So we did our day work in the A-4.
T-A-4J Skyhawk.
Skyhawk. Now it's the T-45. But in the fleet, we do at the end of their FRS tour about 100 hours. They've been there for probably 6 to 9 months, depending on delays, and they're landing it the first time at night. Pretty cool.
Awful.
And it's one of the greatest things as an instructor, as a FRS LSO. It's really cool to take guys to the
oh, yeah,
first
no
time.
Doubt, for sure. All right, so Milan asks, do most operational jets with two seats have dual controls? We covered that earlier, so if you weren't here for that or you probably asked it before and we just hadn't gotten to it yet, then you can go back and listen to that.
But the answer is yes, they do have dual. We can stick on it.
But not, right. But, well, actually, do most operational jets... so no, most training jets will, but most operational.
Yeah, no, yeah, they don't. Yeah, they do not.
Well, not. That's right.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. When you first become a naval fighter pilot, what do you fly to train to become one? And do you guys remember your first F-18 flight? How was it?
Oh,
so
yeah.
what's these days? What does a student go from 0 to 60 in as far as jets go, leading up to an F-18? Do you know?
Well, it's going to be the T-6 Texan for
right.
a primary and a turboprop
mm-hmm.
airplane. If they select jets, they're going to go from there. The T-45. It's that simple.
Yep.
We'll do an intermediate and advanced syllabus. It should take about 2 years to get them through all of that, beginning, intermediate, then advanced jet training. Then they go to the FRS for the F-18. That's another 6 to 9 months, really,
mm-hmm.
Of training. And then you're finally in the fleet. Do I remember my first F-18 flight? I do, but I have a better memory of my first solo because it was in an enhanced performance.
The bigger engines, mm-hmm.
and it was the air show bird. It was completely clean.
Oh, no pylons, no drop tanks.
It just about scared me. I went down in our Owens Valley there where we trained 500 feet, stood it on its tail, and the top of the area, I think it was 28,000 feet,
mm-hmm.
right? And it seemed like it was only 20 seconds before I had... Besides, I was too scared anyway at that point. It was like riding a rocket ship. Now, that was it. That was my first solo.
Yeah.
I remember very distinctly when I put the thing in burner that I'm like, oh, my goodness. Yeah, it was very, very cool.
That is
totally
cool.
Remember it. I remember my first time over the boat like it was yesterday.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
so,
first time in A4, I certainly do.
Yeah.
I remember my first two-seat flight at VMFAT 101 at then Marine Corps Air Station El Toro because it was with the XO, which was the Navy senior guy.
Yeah.
Gutenberger was his name, who had promoted me a few days before. And it was in a jet that, because it had so much trouble, they had painted the word Christine Up on the Tail, which if you remember the show, I don't remember the name of the movie. Was that the movie, Christine?
Yeah.
But it was like some haunted car.
Yeah.
And so they did. They painted Christine on the tail. And this was out at the depot, actually, recently. And it was, we had an emergency on our first flight. And of course, I had him there to help me handle it. I think the APU or something.
So you had the XO.
Or the AMAD,
I had the FRS's one and only at the time. It came from Tomcats, dual anchor, Rio.
On your first flight?
And my first flight. He was my on-wing. So my first four flights were with, so I actually signed for the jet because he couldn't.
Wow.
And so he was allowed to take guys up, but I flew with a two-anchor guy right from the get-go. Great guy.
All right. See? So, you got a love for those guys. Mm-hmm. All right. Who else we got here? Gavin Duff.
Yay.
Hey, Gavin. All right, haha, fly faster.
Hey, Gavin, congrats, man, on everything you're doing.
Yeah, what's his, anyway.
Oh, he's doing fantastic.
I know he is.
For everyone listening, keep that name in your memory.
That's right.
One day, CNO.
We'll have him on here as Airboss, yeah.
Yeah.
How often are hornets washed, CO?
Every 7 days is by instruction.
There you go. This was from Mike Norman. I see some covered in grime and some really clean. Care to keep elaborating?
Well, they do get dirty. They are supposed to be washed every 7 days.
If it's washed on Monday, by Tuesday or Wednesday on the ship.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It gets pretty grimy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's because people inexplicably put their hands on it with grease on their hands.
Yeah,
plus the troubleshooters are touching it as it gets on the
greasy
catapult.
Greasy stuff's blown across.
Stuff's blown around.
Yeah.
But for the most part, we get out there with that bubbly stuff and try to clean. Even the pilots on
days.
Off days, we get out there and do that. So, 7 days. As part of what?
As long as the ship can give us the water and all that kind of stuff, but yes.
Corrosion prevention stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, well that is, let's see, they keep coming. All right, Stephen, yours is going to be the last. We're down to just about 5 minutes left. All right, Rob, you might be the last, but after you, Rob, that's it. What's the heaviest weapons load you have flown with? I don't think I have an answer for this.
The load, I don't know. The largest weapon I ever carried was the Walleye Ertl.
Yeah, so the Walleye, too. I was going to say the same thing. That thing weighed like 2,600 pounds.
Extended range data link is what that Ertl stands for.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like a Volkswagen Bug. It was strapped to my F-18C.
Yeah.
It was a huge, large TV guy. Very cool. Dropped it up in the Utah range up in
Utah. Mm-hmm.
Very memorable because it's such a huge weapon.
Yeah, I remember flying one of those in Puerto Rico before Roosevelt Roads closed. And we were going to employ it, and something happened. We couldn't. And other than that, it's a shame. I don't sit here and say, I had two AMRAAM, two AIM-9, bunch of these, bunch of those. I do remember flying next to a VFA 94 jet. I can't remember who was flying it. And I have a picture of it just loaded with MERS full of 500-pounders.
Yeah.
And I think we went up to Fallon and dropped them. But it might have been Rusty, but I don't remember.
Harm and Jay Sauer, the other,
they're
not
Jay
Sauer, but Harm, big, kind of a big missile.
Yeah, 800-pound missile, 100-pound, I want to say.
Yeah, it's pretty large on the airplane. And nothing like the old glory days with the A6 with the, a rack of 12, 500-pounders on each, each multiple ejection rack.
And you drop them and you leap up because you're so light suddenly. That's right. All right, last question from Rob. Have either of you flown below sea level?
No.
So, I want to correct you. Have you ever landed at El Centro?
Oh, is that below sea level?
Minus 43 feet.
Really?
Yeah.
I guess, I stand correct. I sit corrected quite a bit because I did a lot of debts down there.
I don't
remember that being minus 40 field elevation.
I'm fairly confident that I'm going to stick to my guns on that.
Okay.
We also do fly over Death Valley, Rob.
But never that low.
But we're not supposed to be that low. Now, if you're flying over that particular camp where people prefer to bathe with less than all their clothes on, then some people have been accused of going lower. But no, over Death Valley, we're supposed to stay a little higher.
Any national park, we have to be 3,000 feet or above.
That's right.
So.
But landing at El Centro, which is below sea level, yes, we have.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. Good day from Australia. Well, good day, Mark.
I love Australia. I've been there 6 times, thanks to the Navy.
I don't like
love
being
it.
Off the coast of it. That's the one thing.
Oh, my goodness. Brisbane once. So I did the Crocodile Hunter before the Stingray got him. That was sad.
Oh,
did a zoo there. Did Sydney twice. Perth 3 times. And, love Australia.
Excellent. All right. Well, Dud, we are going to wrap it up. We're just about out of time. I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thanks, Jill. And so before we wrap it up, because you started off with a podcast, and now you're doing these live stuff. So how are things going?
Oh, well, thank you for asking. Wow, it's almost like you were thinking ahead for that. They're going well, thank you. We're doing great. We just launched today our merchandise store. So for anyone who's wanting some cool Fighter Pilot podcast logos or swag or coffee mugs or mouse pads or whatever, it's on our Cafe Press site. So you can find that on Facebook and Patreon. Twitter. We also announced it on, gosh, I don't know where else, but newsletter. That's the other one I was thinking of. So we're doing that. And, you know, I've always said doing this isn't about the money, but enough people came up and said, hey, would you put together some T-shirts and stuff? We'd like to have them. So we did. And right now we have some introductory pricing. So we get a buck maybe or two from each shirt. Cafe Press keeps the rest because they have to make these one at a time. So it's not a huge money-making deal, but that's not the point. People want to show our colors at an air show or wherever, and so now you have that opportunity. And so,
well, man, I got to say, A, I don't get paid a dime for being here, but I'm glad to be here. Thank you. And B, I'm not really on social media. I have none of those things. I have a Facebook account, but I guess people can find me, but I honestly don't even go there anymore. So. But that's great stuff.
Well, you're not getting paid, but I will give you, and I said it wrong with Sunshine, by the way. I said patch. I meant to say a sticker.
Oh,
so here's a cool Fighter Pilot Podcast sticker.
Well, holy cow, Joe, thanks.
And a,
that's a pretty cool looking
a magnet.
Right,
I better, well, yeah. He is good looking, I think.
Yeah.
And a magnet as well for your beer keg or fridge, I mean, or whatever you got.
Awesome.
But yes, you're not getting paid. That's true. And I didn't even buy you lunch before this. That's awful. I should have
done
that.
It's awesome. But, glad to be here. And I think what you're doing here for, you know, I know it's not about, Jill and I have talked about this, you know, in our line of business, it's completely normal to get heckled severely for doing something like this. And we'd all applaud that. Actually, we're glad, and Jill can take it. But it's not about that. It's really about, you know, when I was a kid, even though I'm a third generation aviator, all I wanted to do was fly. And I see from the folks up there, really interested. I would have been a kid glued to this thing. And I'm glad you're out there inspiring the next generation of naval aviators, because we need good pilots out there. And
for
I'll tell you, I know, Jelly, you'd echo the same thing. Yeah, fly for the airlines now. That's great. I wouldn't have done it any differently. My time in the Navy was such a blessing, and the people I worked for. Like I said, if that's Deedle Duff up there, one of the best people you're going to meet, and he's just one of hundreds we could all point to. And so it's been fantastic, and I'm glad you're doing this, and it's great for naval aviation, and I hope the audience enjoys it.
I get emails all the time from people who thank me for doing it. I received one today from a gentleman who flew F-4s in Vietnam, and he said, I listened to it, my wife listened to it, thank you for what you're doing. And the Air Boss on the last episode end said, Jello, thanks for what you're doing for naval aviation. And it's kind of silly, but I get a little bit just warmed by that, because I enjoy doing it. There's people out there that love it. It's the folks that wish they did what we do. And when I hear from them, I just dig it. And then the people who want to do what we do, they reach out also, which is why I was talking to Ham earlier about I need to get someone on here who has been an instructor at a VT squadron recently to service that group. But I like it, and it's not about the money. It's about serving.
Yeah.
A little bit helps because it does take some time, but I enjoy doing it, and it sounds like everybody likes it. So thanks for coming on today.
Thanks, Joe. I appreciate it.
All right. We will see everybody next time. Thanks for tuning in. And any parting shots?
No, thanks for tuning in, all, and I hope you continue to watch Jello and the stuff that he's doing here. It's great work.
Excellent. All right, well, let's get out of here. Now, this is always, again, the awkward part. I should let you, you want to end it? It's fun. All you got to do is hit end.
All right, I'm going to hit end.
Okay.
Thanks, everybody. See ya. Cool.
We were like right at 1 hour. It was great. It was great.
That was great.
Oh, we're still recording. All right, goodbye, everybody. Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post 9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.